Okay, I've got a couple things. I've got chapter 9 and 10 to go through. A final word, I underlined one line in it, and I didn't go through the sample sermon and evaluation this time when I was going through it, and I'll leave that to you. We have an evaluation for Rosedale for this class. Every time a new class is taught, they need to evaluate it. And what I found here in 9 and 10, I'd like to do what I've been doing with it, which is sort of go through it. But you've noticed that it's about delivery. And if we go back to the very beginning of class, you'd think that delivery would be 90% of homiletics. But in fact, it gets pushed aside, and in this case, pushed to the end of the book. When we were talking at our last class about what would you do differently next time, I'm thinking I might just have the students work through chapter 9 and 10 at the beginning of the class rather than the end of class. It might help people who have less experience. Now, Angie and Brad have been public speaking, and Zach, you've got good enough style and form. As I said, I was not concerned about delivery issues. From the minute all three of you got up, I thought, well, that'll be a breeze, because nobody's got any egregious problems going on with their speaking as just presentation issues. And we touched on it a little, of course. So I showed you various PowerPoints and things I stole from my public speaking class, and I've got a few more of those to go through today. But it is one thing I thought, maybe this should be moved to the front of the class. What do you think? Is that a sound idea? What's in chapter 9 and 10? Well, I'm thinking what would produce anxiety in the heart of a student. It wouldn't necessarily be the prepping of a sermon. I mean, that would obviously cause a little anguish, but I think the idea of getting up and doing it, that's still enough to make a person nervous. And so having all the tools in place for public speaking seems valuable to me. But okay, well, let's go down through 9 and 10, and I'll be ducking out to look at things on our PowerPoints. First thing in chapter 9 here, Angie, you can follow along, especially when I said if you ever want to borrow my book to see what I've underlined since you're in a different edition, but try to follow along best as you can. We talked about, he talks about manuscripts here, which is interesting. Not all preachers, I'm in the second full paragraph, write out their sermons, nor do preachers who write out sermons write out every sermon, but the discipline of preparing a manuscript improves preaching. And then he has one of his famous metaphors, scrapes the fungus off of our thought. That's probably how I picked up when I preach. I often have a word-for-word manuscript these days. I don't read them. I've long since learned to write in such a way that it's for speaking, not for reading. And we've talked about that here in the class, that a writer might have dependent clauses and all kinds of things, because a reader can always go back over the same material. He'll keep touching on that. But a speaker has to deliver their words a little differently. But it was the discipline issue of it for me. I was up against it usually as a preacher. I worked another job. I had to get a sermon in there when I could. It was simply easier to do it that way. I found outlining actually took me longer. So I started doing it the other way. But however you do it, it's an important discipline for most people. As we said at the beginning of class, there are people who, and churches and groups that don't value that part of preaching. The idea that someone should sit down with a pencil and paper Wednesday night and map it out seems to rob it of its spiritual vitality, and they'll mock you for it. I think I'm there. I would so much rather listen to a prepared sermon. I want somebody to have thought about it. I feel if the Holy Spirit can speak to you Sunday morning while you're standing in the pulpit, there's no reason why the Holy Spirit can't speak to you Wednesday night when you're sitting at your desk. It seems completely invalid to me. But nonetheless, the other thing I said about that earlier in the class was that I felt that everybody's doing preparation. Even those people who claim to get into a pulpit without notes and let the Spirit lead them have in fact prepared in their mind certain pathways that they go down. They know their scriptures. They know what they're studying. They have a sense about what needs to be delivered to the congregation, and they may not put on paper ahead of time, but in fact mentally they're doing much the same thing. All right, so I'm on page 185 where I started outlining again. sort of over the same territory. If you're willing to work at it, you can become more skillful with them than you are. He's referring to language here. We must use words, and the only question is whether we will use them poorly as well. And then he suggests not comparing yourself right away to Lewis Muggeridge or Philip Yancey. Let those artists provide an ideal toward which you can move, but in every sermon, you can strive to be clear and exact in what you mean. Sage advice. I don't know that it needs elaborated on tremendously, but the idea is that our tool, the chief tool in our kit, really, is our use of words. And working at that certainly isn't unworthy of what we're doing as a preacher. Down here at the bottom, while rules governing good writing also apply to the sermon manuscript, a sermon is not an essay on its hind legs. I didn't quite get that metaphor, and so I underlined it to see if you could help me. What does he mean there? 185 bottom. A sermon is not an essay on its hind legs. I'm not sure how that works, but I get totally the idea that writing an essay and writing a sermon are different. We've talked about it a great deal, but how, in fact, this hind legs thing gets worked in there, no clue. More going on with his sage advice. Your manuscript is not your final product. Your sermon is. Your sermon should not be read to a congregation. 186, and he'll be repetitive with this. Rehearse several times aloud without your manuscript. I'm not sure that that's perfect advice. Why pretend it's not there or not use it? Perhaps that helps if you are looking for a more spontaneous delivery, if you feel you're too anchored to your text, you're a little bit stiff and you need to loosen up. Perhaps that would be a good exercise, but I don't see really any particular value in that kind of rehearsal. I think what's more important is rehearsal. A lot of pastors don't rehearse sermons, but as I said, I do pretty carefully. All right, writing, once again, on this back to this topic, writing a sermon differs from writing an essay or a book. Write as though you were talking with someone and in conversation. And here this last phrase is the most important part of this. Strive for immediate understandings. And that would be echoed at the very last sentence of that paragraph above strong transitions. Speakers, unlike writers, must make themselves understood instantly. And that probably is the good trick of it, of writing in such a way that you're writing to speak it, not to leave it on the page. It has to be instantly apprehended. Not only has to be instantly apprehended, but there's a lot of information that's preceding it and following it. The person can't really take a lot of time to ponder anything you've said without losing the next point or losing the last point. And so, we'll see there are some techniques there, but you have to strive for instant understanding, and that would be a good rule of thumb working there. Strong transitions. We talked about this a little bit already, but we're on 187, second full paragraph. Transitions serve as road signs to point out where the sermon has been and where it is going. Transitions, therefore, are longer and more detailed than in writing. And that's true, and this is a place where I think I've failed as a preacher for a long time. I remember in Alabama, I think it was my associate pastor's wife who told me, at least maybe not bluntly, but gently as she could, that she had trouble following point to point what I was saying. I was jumping too fast, and I thought, well, that's probably good advice. A person who's trying to follow the way you think needs a lot of transition there. So I put a line right down that paragraph on 187 for advice about structure there, about how to do major transitions. Strong transitions will usually review the major points already covered and show the listener how the points relate to the major idea. It's minor transitions, single words, therefore, besides, yet, consequently, in addition to. At the bottom, then, I underlined a full sentence again. Clear, full, definite transitions look clumsy on paper, but they run easily in a sermon, and they enable your congregation to think your thoughts with you. A major reason that sermons fail to be clear is that the transitions have not been well crafted. As I said, I felt like I was telling you to simplify your messages a little bit, and I think I'd still hold that advice, having listened to all your sermons, that it doesn't need to be dumbed down. The point can be profound, and you don't at all have to be repetitive, but the idea is you've got this idea, this hermeneutical idea, and you take, say, three complements, and you bring them to it. But in each case, you should be linking these to each other and constantly bringing them back to the main idea. And the more you can develop the picture, the more illustration you can use. He'll talk about that a great deal. The better your listener has of grasping it. And as I said, if the thought's profound, you don't run the risk of being shallow here. You don't want to hammer people over the head with the same point over and over, but you do want to be clear. Okay, a clear style. I got over to page 189. I liked his statement at the top. Some preachers have jerky minds. While they have stimulating insights, their thoughts follow no natural sequence, and their zigzag thinking runs listeners to death. I've gotten more tolerant with going with the flow than I used to be when I was young. I had a very, when it came to this stuff, a very convergent mind. I didn't like things to go out. I liked them to come together. And I was very critical of people who were more divergent in their approaches to preaching. I thought, well, that's a good idea, but moving it towards one point was important. All I can say is people have different tolerance levels. Congregations have different tolerance levels. Some people don't really even go expecting a sermon to be going in a straight line. They expect to be gleaning little bits of insight along the way. Might have nothing to do with a main point, but be careful with it. I think if you have a tendency to want to put a lot in, be careful you're convergent enough. Short sentences, to be clear, keep your sentences short. That's 89, the middle. Simple words, and on 190, and jargon. We talked about that early in the class and how jargon can cuts two ways. There's insider language that establishes identity and credibility with an audience. It comforts them. It gives them orientation points. But if it's a jargon that excludes them, then you're in trouble. If it pushes them aside or makes you an expert, or if it's just a bullying way of establishing superiority. He has some things down here. If you pepper your sermons with words like eschatology, angst, pneumatology, exegesis, existential, Johannine, and the Christ event, you throw up barriers to communication. Say, well, probably. I used to, in Alabama in particular, because we had a fair number of people who were not terribly well educated in the congregation, I would often go over my manuscript and eliminate polysyllabic words as much as I could. If it had more than two syllables in it, I would get her in. And it was not that the people were dumb. Some of them were very, very bright people, but they weren't used to that level of verbal approach, and so they'd get intimidated. Now, one of the things I've learned to do is that people like big words, actually, and they don't mind learning them, but if you use them, you ought to just stop and explain them. So, whereas I think he says don't say eschatology, I would say eschatology. But when you're in your sermon, say eschatology. Now, that's the big word we use when we're talking about the last things, the study of the return of Christ. Just tell them what it means. And or tell them what it means and then give them the word, and then they feel like, hey, I'm equipped, you know. I can pull that one out if I want to. If you don't define it, though, you're going to be in real trouble. 192, top of the page, last full paragraph. His rule of thumb should be, don't overestimate your audience's religious vocabulary or underestimate their intelligence. And that would be another thing to think of here. They may not, especially if you're outside certain Christian worlds, they don't have the religious vocabulary down that you may have grown up with and find easy enough to use, but that doesn't mean they're dumb otherwise. They just don't know that vocabulary, so they might be quite capable of piercing your thought and seeing illogical connections and things like that, but at the same time they wouldn't necessarily follow the vocabulary. And then 193, last full paragraph. Well, wait, I'm jumped one here, 192. I like Donald Bryant and Carl Wallace describe as the vivid realization of an idea at the moment of utterance. We're once again back to what's the nature of spoken language. I feel like he's being a little bit roundabout in his presentation. He's talked about this already, the idea of immediate apprehension of the words. And coming back to that same idea here is the spoken language. The vivid realization of an idea at the moment of utterance is what you're after. And then 193 at the bottom, last full paragraph of the section, the language of effective preaching should be the language of stimulating conversation between thoughtful people. I'm going to charge through this and come back to the PowerPoints I use in public speaking because they say the same thing. So we'll hit these things twice. A vivid style. What does vivid mean?
I think of something not real. Something that's, I guess, it's real clear. It's right there. It's clear. You can see it and apprehend it clearly and easily. I know there's a better way. That's I can do it now.
Well, things that are vivid are memorable. But I have a vivid memory of the time we went to the beach. What would that mean? Well, it would be distinct. What's that?
Let me be clear on a certain...
Yeah, but what makes it that way? I say I have a vivid memory of the time, you know.
What makes it vivid?
Specific?
Well... You had a tremendous vivid example, I thought, in your talk the other day in chapel. I don't mean to bring up a sad subject, but about chocolate.
Oh yeah.
I thought that's a vivid memory for her. Yeah. What do we mean?
Takes you back.
Well, yeah, vivid like viva, vivir in Spanish, to live. It's alive. It's still alive. So in a sense, it's in motion. It's not trapped in the past. So I was thinking that with your chocolate example, Angie, is it's still alive. It's still affecting you. It's still there. It can be played out in your brain, and it's not just a picture from the past or a picture from the book. It's still in a sense happening. You understand? I mean, I think that's a vivid means alive. It's not dead or parked somewhere in memory. And so if you give that to people, it's very exciting. I mean, to hear it, they go, wow, I can enter into that person's vivid picture of what they're there. I wasn't there, but vicariously I kind of attached to it and think, wow, that person can still walk down that street, still talk to their grandfather. They're there. It's alive. It's in motion. It's a movie. It's not a photograph, I guess you'd say. You get me? That's the vivid style here, and he talks about this in 193 with his vivid style. And he says one of the ways you capitalize on that is you get to things because of your senses. You interpret the world around you through your hearing, sight, smell, taste, and touch. To get your listeners to experience your message, therefore you must appeal to their senses. And so that's why you say it in such a way that brings them there. Those of you who took Gospel of John with me might remember, like, in the Gospel of John, where he'll say something like that brings your senses in. When Mary anoints Jesus' feet, she says, the fragrance filled the whole house. And suddenly you feel you've got this vivid attachment to a person who was there. You just don't think of that kind of thing if you're not, well, you could say it. I mean, I guess you could force yourself to imagine that, but it makes it a live memory. Or in that place there was much grass, and you almost get the feeling like the person's just playing it out in their mind, and suddenly the smell of the ointment or the pleasant quality of the green grass and sitting in it all comes through your senses to you. I like it. Vividness increases, this is 194, the first full paragraph, increases when you use specific concrete details and plenty of them. We label a phrase specific when it is explicit and exact, specific if it's explicit and exact, and concrete if it paints a picture on the mind. I have trouble with that concrete, because concrete sounds kind of dead and cold and stolid to me. But in fact, I think when public speaking and homiletics pulls at this, the thing concrete is the picture on the mind. And he gets into some things here that I've said that are very important. If you're using figures like money, paint a picture of what it means. You did this a little bit with your rudder example and trying to get us the dimensions of the ship. I mean, it gets too big, it's too abstract unless it comes down to something that we can start to picture in our mind. When you said a quarter of a mile, suddenly the size of that ship became much more enormous, you know, and the contrast to a 29-foot rudder became much more clear in my mind, whereas when somebody just says that's, I don't know how many feet you mentioned, but it's off the charts. His choice here is the figure 1,923,212.92 is specific down to the penny, so that's specific language, but it is not concrete. The figure 275 on your monthly electric bill is concrete. So that you tell people, I opened the bill, I held the envelope, I saw smoke came out my ears as I looked at the price. Everybody's in there with you. It's painting a picture on the mind. They communicate the experience to the audience. I liked his examples here, and I thought they were worth it. Instead of saying produce, say cabbages, cucumbers, carrots, and oranges. Don't say weapon. Talk about a heavy lead pipe. Don't mention major cities. Refer to New York, Chicago, Dallas, San Francisco. And work with it that way. And he takes the example out of Ecclesiastes, and I felt like that was a fine example there. You must learn to think in pictures. That means you must visualize details. I liked his thing from Flaubert and Maupassant there. Look on 195 over there when he talks about a language, and we're still in this vivid category here. Take the time to find the words that express it clearly. It really helps. When somebody just says, well, you know, it's like really hot and yeah. Think, no, I mean, that says that person's mind is lazy. They haven't taken the time to find the language that will tell you how hot it was there. So you come up with some things. He has, be especially careful of qualifiers like very, so, quite, rather, too. They betray our failure to choose words of substance. Scalding has a strength that very hot does not. Excruciating hurts more than too painful. Scintillating paints a better picture than it was so interesting. And he goes on like that. Verbs like nouns wake up the imagination when they are precise. She went gets her there, but not as clearly as she crawled, she stumbled, she shuffled, she lurched. He shouts, shrieks, rants, whisper, tell us things that says do not say. I really liked his vivid language examples. I think he worked with them pretty well. Would you look at 196 there, metaphors and similes? You know, a metaphor is comparing things, and if you use a like or as, it becomes a simile, and there are all kinds of more specific ideas of this. He had ones that he thought were... He said, figures of speech can serve time by packing more into a phrase than word-wasting speakers express in a paragraph. And he has some cool ones there, I thought, pretty good. He avoided the sticky issues as though he were stepping around puddles of hot tar. That worked for me because I grew up on a street that had stones and tar on the... Hot tar and stones in it. It was real clear to me. Look at the ones he says hardly reached the chin. People become tone deaf. This doesn't have punch. Outreach of the church, tried and true, lost and dying world, born again Christians, throw out the baby with bathwater, souls for your hire. I have never heard that. What is that? I was wondering, does this come from some Christian tradition I've just never ever bumped into? A prayer hearing and prayer answering God, straddle the fence, sharing or fellowship, find different words for him. I think what he's saying is that canned canned imagery like that becomes cliche and people tune it out. Whereas if you come up with original ones, he certainly strains to do it sometimes. You keep people's imagination. One of the things I was noticing starting at this point in the book is how old some of his references are, in both in terms of his research and in terms of the examples of preaching, I think are from a church world that is already somewhat past. 197 at the top, common observation tells us what linguistic tests have proved. Much of the language used in our pulpits is imprecise, irrelevant, and insignificant. I went down there to footnote 10, and you see when that research was probably done. Yeah, I'm thinking, well, I don't know. That's a long time ago. That's a half a century ago, easily, and maybe more. And so I think, be careful. I mean, I'm not sure that kind of research can be called on about this point. How do you shun the sin of boring people? Pay attention to your audience and language, show how others use language, and read aloud. And let me go to some PowerPoints here to show you things I've used for public speaking in this regard. What's that?
On Saturday night, when I think that part of my routine to read poetry or some kind of work like that to increase my vocabulary.
You like that?
Here and there, I don't mind reading stuff like that, just as long as I can understand it.
I didn't get it. Where is it? What's your? Is it 198? He talks about reading.
Yeah, number two, I think, on 197. Law of poetry first.
Oh yeah.
Speakers are shaky. Yeah. I remember one book. I don't know why I read it when I did.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a great book.
I determined to finish it. I don't know what it was about, really, but I remember sitting down with a dictionary beside me because, like, every other word, I think I wrote.
Well, he's writing in the 19th century in New England, and he was pretty literary. I bought a copy of the book, The House of Seven Gables, at the House of Seven Gables in Salem, Massachusetts. Yeah, I like Hawthorne, but
let me get off color real quick. That was about, wasn't it, the person who did, or something about the man who owned it was falsely accused of something so that other people could own the property.
It's been many years since I've read it, and I'm trying to remember how that worked. Yeah, there was something about that House of Seven Gables that was important and who was living there. But I can't remember the storyline without refreshing my memory on it. Okay, let's see. Let's see, I'm going to hold these PowerPoints to the next chapter because I think he gets more into those parts of the delivery thing. We'll talk about language in a moment again, but I think that was the part of it here. Let's move into chapter 10, how to preach so people will listen. And of course this is where he gets into all kinds of the nitty-gritty of delivery. 201, first, second full paragraph, the effectiveness of our sermons depends on two factors, what we say and how we say it. Both are important. We walk a fine line with this, obviously. We've said all along that if the Holy Spirit isn't a factor, I mean, if you didn't believe that, I suppose preaching would be a whole different experience, but I suppose everybody coming through Rosedale anyway is believing the Holy Spirit is present in the preaching, and that even a lame sermon may be effective in that sense because God will use it in a life. Now, I don't think you ever want to lose sight of that idea. I believe it, and it certainly comforts me. At the same time, if you use it as a mask for failure to prepare or failure to work at it, I think the Lord certainly isn't pleased with that, that he's given us a calling. And so working at it is we don't want to hide behind the idea of the Holy Spirit being present. We want to cooperate with the Holy Spirit in making God's Word effective, and that should be our chief goal, really, in preaching. 1202 at the top, every empirical study of delivery and its effect on the outcome of a speech or sermon arrives at an identical conclusion. Your delivery matters a great deal. Once again, I don't think that will ever become false as information. That study comes from 1967 in this book. He has, over on 203, a formula we've used. I've never heard it attributed, but I use it about just the nonverbal signals the body sends and how quickly people pick up on them and how if they're not working together, they produce a lack of confidence in the speaker. If their words are going one direction and their face is going another direction with what they're saying, they're trying to speak about joy but they seem angry, or happiness and they don't seem happy, it will create an unbearable tension, and people then will usually decide in favor of the nonverbal signals telling the real story. In other words, they won't give the words the value of the doubt, the benefit of the doubt, but they will give the nonverbal signals. Over on page 203, Albert Mehrabian broke it down to a formula. Only 7% of a speaker's message comes through his words, 38% springs from his voice, 55% comes from his facial expressions. This comes from 1971. This research relates to preachers and preaching. First, our nonverbal language has strategic importance. When we address a congregation, three different communication networks operate at the same time: our words, our intonation, and our gestures. Keep that in mind. All three communicate ideas. Second, if nonverbal messages contradict the verbal, listeners will more likely believe the silent language. And I'm not sure how he fit this one in when I was looking at it. The third observation that he has under this section about the idea of desire, what is it you want to do? I feel like that's very important. I'm not sure how it fits here, though. Amateurs settle for getting their ideas out of their heads, while professionals strive to get ideas into our heads. Well, apply this to pastoring. I mean, it's not enough to declare. You want to convince. Obviously, what does he say in that one chapter? That a sermon calls for a verdict in its conclusion. You want to have entered in, not just put a proposition out for evaluation, but delivered a message that brings healing and light and God's presence in some way, new way, into a life, and that if this isn't your desire, you're missing it. So when we concentrate on ideas with the desire to make listeners understand and accept them, strong delivery comes naturally. Well, not necessarily true. Sincerity is not the test here, but I think people sense right away if you have no passion about what you're talking about and don't respond well. And they do respond well to people who clearly are interested in the topic at hand.
So then the challenge for that would be, how do you preach an Old Testament sermon from Leviticus and sound?
Well, that's the challenge. I think sometimes you have to preach things that you don't feel deeply. But you must feel that there's a reason to bring them to the pulpit, that people need to hear this Sunday. But it can be a challenge. If you only preach about the things you're passionate about, you'll have a reduced repertoire of sermons. You'll preach five sermons over and over again, and people really will get sick of you pushing the same buttons. So you do have to find a way out of that trap, too.
And that wouldn't be fair.
No, it's way too limited. I really do feel that one of the great problems with preaching and teaching in the church at this point in history is that people are just fabulously bored. They've heard the same thing, said the same way too many times without a sense of inspiration and without being challenged to think about it as an adult. And so they've heard it all before. For a lot of congregations, it would be one thing if you were preaching to new Christians who hadn't grown up in church the way I had, but I feel like there's a lot of room to push some ideas out here and to say them in different ways. All right, he talks about movement in the pulpit. Therefore, the movement of your body must be disciplined to be effective. And then at first attempts to improve your delivery will feel unnatural. Novices may insist they should abandon the effort because a minister is not an actor and working on delivery violates their personality. But throw that idea out. The idea of working on it is very good. He talks about obesity on 206. I thought that was very interesting in our program of regular exercise and proper diet and pounds. This may be getting out of hand here. It is hard to believe that a preacher who is 30 pounds overweight takes seriously the biblical injunctions about self-control. That is particularly true in areas of the country that are health conscious. That is true. There are parts of the world where you could say certain things and they would not go over well. But you get states and cities that are much more health conscious, diet conscious, that maybe for all the wrong reasons. Maybe because they're self-absorbed and vain people. But if you delivered certain lines there that showed you didn't care about that particular issue, yeah, those nags tell me I shouldn't be eating so much fried chicken or something, you thought, good heavens, you know, you're sitting there with a group of people that are, you know, kind of, they're going to go biking for 50 miles that afternoon, and they're all tan and fit and vegetarian. They're going to sit there and say, who's this guy? There are those places in the country. As you go west, they're out there, and it's fascinating. I just thought, I don't get into this in some ways, but I think it is interesting. In the South where I was, it would have been fine form to eat a lot, brag about it, and complain about the health nags in Washington who don't believe that, you know, fat and sugar are good for you, and how that's, and everybody would laugh and everybody would be on the page. I'll bet you do that in Portland, Oregon, and people would think, what a clod. We had to pray for you after the service, you know. Whatever else this guy says, he needs help in that department. I wrote ROFL after a paragraph on 207 here. A male speaker may wear a tie when men in the audience are wearing sports shirts. I thought, well, that's okay. I mean, the idea of the pastor dressing one step up over their congregation, that I can say that probably hasn't changed in a sense. But in most Sunday services, a suit for a man or a woman is appropriate. And ROFL on the side. The number of churches where all men are in ties and suits is so limited at this point. I just think you could walk into a church and feel really overdressed wearing a suit at this point, and thinking, be careful, be sensitive to it. I think he lives in a different world. Men in your church wear suits? Really?
Mostly older, more so older ones.
Locust Grove, suits?
Some of the older people.
Well, you probably have some plain coats and things in those congregations, right? I don't know how it is in your world, Angie, but it just depends so much in where you are. I think if you were a man and walked into my congregation with a suit on, you'd feel uncomfortable. You'd feel like you were strangely overdressed, uncomfortably so. If a person got into the pulpit in a suit, even, I think at this point people would be, who's this guy? You know, why would they think they were that we wanted them to present themselves that way? I'm going to guess it would be that way in a lot of churches at this point. They used to say in door-to-door evangelism and church planting, for example, that in some places in the East, in the South, wearing a tie was a good idea. So don't do it in California. Yeah, it'll send all the wrong signals. I mean, they'll think you're either in a cult or you must represent the federal government, or, you know, you must be like an inspector or something. You know, why would you come in a, you know, in a tie to my door? It would just put people off right away.
What's ROFL?
Rolling on the floor laughing. You must not send that texty stuff around on your phone. What's that?
I mean, I think I have heard of it.
It's old now. There are many substitutes for that now, but it was what was on my mind. I thought, whoa, he lives in New England and he's from a different generation. Content should motivate movement, and we've talked about this perhaps too much. I've said that the idea always with your body is to since you're on display, everything you do is a tool. If you're just pacing around out of nervous energy, it loses its effect. But if you stay put and bring it under your control, at that moment that you come out from behind a podium or a pulpit, then suddenly becomes a tremendous statement. People are paying attention. Why is that point? So you use these things to your advantage. If you're out and you're being informal, but then you come behind the pulpit and stand stiff for a moment, you have people's attention. They're going to wonder why that point is punctuated with that particular body movement. And the idea is bringing it all under control. This is why you have to be very careful about clutching podiums that keep your hands down. One thing I noticed with everybody here is you're not keeping your feet down all the time. We'll get a foot up behind the other foot while you're preaching. That shifts your body weight, that weakens your posture, and it also makes you unready to go. I'd say it's why a lot of speaking books say plant your feet shoulder width apart. If you move from this position, move for a reason, and it will communicate. If you do something just habitually because you do it, it has no effect. It's a tool that's lost. And that's what he goes on about, 208, 209. He talks about gestures then 210, 211. When he got to varied gestures on 211, he had a person who counted gestures. We can produce 700,000 distinct elementary signs with our arms, wrists, hands, and fingers. That footnote, by the way, leads to a source in 1930. So once again, I'm thinking, watch this guy's research. It's old with that. But I think the idea is not lost on us. Eye contact and eye formulas, and then vocal delivery. And we talked a little about vocal delivery, but take his points. There aren't that many things you can do with your voice. He calls them pitch, punch, progress, and pause. That is an example of a what? Pitch, punch, progress, pause.
Is that with all the same letters, you mean?
Yes. No?
That's the phrase. I always get that.
Yeah. Alliteration. And you do things alliteratively. Why?
Memory,
yeah. So he'll have to define what these things mean, though. But it's a good... As we've said, there isn't that much you can do with your voice. Pitch is the up and down in the scale. The voice up and down with various inflections. Sometimes the melody in what you're saying. Punch is the loudness. Progress is the rate. That's the speed at which you talk. And pause. And we talked about that. Pausing is really welcome in a sermon, and it punctuates a point. As long as you don't pause at a stupid moment, you can make that very effective. Either before you say something or after you say something, a pause will get attention from people. He has a 219, beginners profit from rehearsing with a full voice while standing before a mirror using a tape recorder, or a phone, probably, or a tablet. You have a recording app, I'm sure. More experienced speakers settle for a sotto voce as they mumble through their sermons. A sotto voce is the stage whisper. The soft voice, I'm not sure. For a few, sitting and thinking through their sermons, animated in their imagination by a picture of themselves before their congregation will be enough. I wrote out in the paragraph, outside the paragraph, I disagree. I think full rehearsal is good for all speakers at all levels. I really advocate to you, when you're preaching, get up and give it. give it in your full voice. Find an attic, find a field, find a room, do it. See, Billy Graham used to walk out into like a swampy area, right, and stand on a stump somewhere outside his Bible college and preach to the frogs. I don't remember the anecdote exactly, but he spoke that way. Is it Demosthenes, the Greek orator, who put stones in his mouth and tried to speak over the waves at the sea? Full voice really helps. Really helps you know how things are coming across. Well, let's look at some things here. These are the PowerPoints I use in public speaking, and I think they cover a lot of the same ground. So maybe these things should come first. This chapter 8 is from my public speaking book. We have the same repetition here. Consider the nonverbal aspects. 55% of your content is delivered by your facial expression and body expression. That really matters to people. 38% the vocal quality. 7% the words themselves. A repetition of what's in Haddon Robinson's book. So at least you know there are two books that agree. And here again, when body, face, voice, and words are synchronized, your words are taken at face value. If they're going in the same direction, everybody's believing. Now, Robinson added that other insight, which is, if they don't disagree, people are going to go with the nonverbal communication for the real meaning of what you're saying. Eye contact formula, he has that, of course, and we skip by it. I say make sure your script is legible. That's one of the first things I see in public speaking students, is that they're too busy trying to understand what's on their text so that they're burying their head at key moments, and that interferes with their ability to hold eye contact with people. So make sure your script's legible. Concentrate on ideas rather than words. That's another example of something right that Robinson will echo here. Your brain usually will supply words. And they'll probably supply the words you practiced. It's just slight variations. You're not going to get there and be at a loss for words themselves if you have the ideas. People who don't engage others with their eyes are judged less credible than those who do. Eye contact formula, look at your notes, absorb one idea, look up at one person, engage eyes, speak your idea to that person in minimum 5 seconds, and repeat cycle. Now let me look at Brad for 5 seconds, and you tell me when 5 seconds is up, okay? Too long, right? It's too long to be staring at one person.
I mean, the first couple is okay, but I think...
It gets creepy then, doesn't it? What's wrong here? I think a couple seconds is fine. The idea is to engage, if you can find one person, engage them for a moment, but 2 seconds probably do it, otherwise you're going to give them the creeps. Reduce random movement. Once again, learn, think about, experiment with deliberate movement. He doesn't like practicing gestures. He thinks they'll be badly timed and unworked. I don't think that's true. You had a gesture that I liked. It was real deliberate. Somebody was grabbing something. And I was thinking, he probably rehearsed that and worked that. I mean, it was really a point, but it mattered. I don't know why it mattered. I don't know why it matters now, but at the time it mattered in your sermon. What were we grabbing?
It was the opening verse that we all stumble in many ways. There's numerous things that kind of like grab onto us to pull us down.
Grab onto us and pull us down. Did you practice that?
I think I did, maybe somewhere. I think I was going through my... I was speaking and like, hey, that'd be a good thing to do.
It looked rehearsed to me, but it looked fine. I thought, that's good. And that's why I think he overstates his case. There would be a point at which practicing it might be a really good idea. If you're going to clap your hands, don't be wimpy. You know, if you're, say, we will all be changed in the twinkling of an eye. But if you're, in the twinkling of an eye, you know, twinkling of an eye, you know, that would wake somebody up, but like if you mess up there, you're in trouble. Or he danced a light step, you know, and they think, oh good Lord. Not him, please.
What do you do with, like, because I know for me, I do this a lot. Whenever I was talking, did that seem to get old? Like, every time I make a statement, I'd be doing it. Because, like, when I was reading a book and I talked about, like, varied And he said if you do the same thing over and over again, people get really annoyed. They just watch you.
I'm probably not the man to ask, since I talk a lot with my hands and probably repeat my gestures a lot. The idea, I think, is probably to bring it under as much conscious control as you can. I have a lot of tolerance. I like gesture. I like people who speak with their hands. It matters to me that they have their hands up. Excuse me?
I guess the contents the key would be if the contents aren't really there, you're just doing it just for the sake of doing it.
Yeah, flapping your arms, that isn't probably a good idea. Work the frame. I told you about that at the very beginning. This idea that you're given a certain turf in any church, and your confidence and comfort within that frame matters a lot to people. So we've talked about that. And we talked about making it appropriate to the size room that you're in. Keep gestures above the waist, and that's, of course, so people can see them. As I said, you can be gesticulating madly behind a big podium, and no one's going to see it. If you're shorter in particular, I noticed Angie, when she was talking, had the good sense to come out often to the side here. I mean, you could see her. If she were to stand completely behind here, it would be... There's not as much of her to be seen as there is of you guys, and some of her gesture and body language would be lost on us. Stance, plant your feet and shoulders, distribute weight evenly, never lean away from the audience. If you move from this position, do it deliberately and consciously make a point. We talked about body language in that sense. Place your hands lightly on the sides of the podium. I said podiums, avoid leaning, drumming, clutching for dear life to a podium. If the podium is too big for you, stand beside it or in front of it. At the very least, come out from behind it a few times if you can. I said, remember room reconnaissance, know what you're getting into. Or even if you're being called to preach, instead of fretting about your content, which you should have prepared, take a moment to look at the room and say, oh my, yeah, that podium's big, or it's going to take a little bit to get up there, a little bit of time. How do I want to approach it confidently? Or say, that corner of the church is far away and there are a lot of people sitting in it. I better start addressing them early and often, or they'll disengage from me. I mean, do that even as you're evaluating a room before you sum, even the same room. You know, I preach at LCF with some regularity, but I could say Sunday by Sunday it might present new challenges depending on who's there and where they've sat and things like that and where I'll be approaching from. Okay, other ideas. Okay, clothing counts. He talks about dress there. One thing he doesn't say that we teach in public speaking is that you address inversely according to how controversial your message is. A boring accountant's report, that guy can wear a red suit and, you know, clown paint if he wants to. It'll only liven things up. If your message is controversial, you don't want your dress to be controversial. Say that people delivering really controversial messages ought to dress really conservatively. It just, any little step they have towards identifying with their crowd is very important to them. Say avoid jewelry, and that's not a problem of sort of Mennonite plainness. Jewelry makes a racket in some cases. If it's on your wrist and you have dangling earrings here, and you've got mics like this, men and women. I had a tie that someone gave me, and I thought I'd wear it just because I'd wear it, and it had little jeweled things on it. And I didn't think much of it. It's not the kind of tie I would wear typically, but it's a nice tie, and I put it on because somebody had just given it to me at Christmas and I was preaching. Unbelievable. It hit the lights. It would like flash at the congregation. They're getting the wrong signal about me. I'm not a flashy person. That turned apparently zing. It's a little jewel zing out there. It's amazing what things like this will do to you. And so I think, unless you're after that effect, I would watch it. Other PowerPoints I had that sort of echoed what he said. That's effective presentation. Let's do... I had speech construction here, and we've talked about that both with our openings. I think I showed you this very PowerPoint here in ways to do it, and then cut out there because it wouldn't fit so much to preaching. I seem to have lost a PowerPoint here. Hang on. I thought I had it here. Examples. There you are. I wanted to go into this when you're talking about the language you use, because I think it's important here. Alliteration. We already talked about punch, pauses, pitch, and what? Pitch, pause, punch. Pitch, pause, punch. Progress, okay. Alliteration as a way to make things work. Careless cars cutting corners create confusion, crossing center lines. So you see, that's a whole poem, of course. Alliteration. The tricolon we've talked about. Things organized in groups of three are tremendously powerful and tremendously memorable. We say this once again in public speaking. He doesn't go into that so much. Anaphora, the idea of repeating things, and he has several examples there. In a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot concentrate, we cannot hallow the ground by Lincoln. We cannot, we cannot, we cannot. That's the anaphora. When Martin Luther King says, I have a dream, I have a dream, I have a dream, that's an anaphora. And it works with things. It might be a little bit stilted in some sermon settings, but it wouldn't be bad to keep repeating a phrase like that if it matters. Say in a formal sermon, like a Sunday, like an Easter sermon. It was that famous Tony Campola thing. It's Friday, but Sunday's coming. Repeat it a few times. See if it doesn't work. A syndeton. This was mentioned earlier in your book, omits conjunctions between words and phrases or clauses, and it's to speed up things. You take out the and. There's another word for the type if you take out the disjunctive ones, but they're conjunctive ones. He was this town at its best, hard driving, working feverishly, pushing, building, driven by ambitions so big they seemed Texas boastful. You could put ands in these kinds of things, but when you string them along with commas, it gives you a kind of a gallop in your speech, and it really works well. He was a bag of bones, a floppy doll, a broken stick, a maniac. So much for Kerouac. Balance is a wonderful tool, and if you can use it in a sermon, it's worth doing it. And it's the idea of rising and fall, posing two elements with one pitch going up and the second one going down. To err is human, but to forgive is divine. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, which actually was misquoted, I understand. But all that rising and falling. Be willing to deliver those punchlines. I've been teaching Proverbs over at Shiloh Church in the Sunday mornings, and a lot of Proverbs work that way. They're either connected with an and or the term but. I say, when you're reading them, get that. A wise son is a blessing to his father, but a foolish son, disgraces his mother, or whatever it is. You get that rising, falling thing. Don't be afraid to deliver it as a punchline. It really works. That's just my echo of everything that Haddon Robinson's talking about here. Well, I've been through that book two or three times now. I kind of like it. It's pretty good.